The New Statesman. The UK is on course for a huge rise in preventable illness. The Health Foundation charity predicts that by 2040, one in five adults will be living with a serious condition such as cancer, dementia, or heart disease. Meanwhile, economic activity is stagnating, with roughly 2.8 million people currently out of work due to ill health, according to the latest figures from the Office for National Statistics. Our world-leading life sciences sector has the capacity to help reverse this trend. In 2021 alone, it contributed £43.3 billion to the UK economy and supported 646,000 jobs. With the right investment, it could add an additional £68 billion to GDP over the next 30 years, create 85,000 more jobs, and result in a 40% decrease in disease burden across the UK. This episode, in partnership with professional services firm PwC, explores how greater investment into vital disease areas such as cancer, obesity, and immunology could make British society physically and financially healthier. I'm joined by Cheon Wura, the Shadow Minister for Science, Research and Innovation, Dr. Dan Mahoney, Chair of the UK Bioindustry Association and the Government's Life Sciences Investment Envoy, and Stephen Ahern, Pharmaceutical and Life Sciences Leader at PwC UK. Thanks to all of you for joining me. Chi, let's start with you. What is the current standing of the UK life sciences sector and what greater potential does it have?
Well, Emma, first of all, thanks to you for having me on the podcast and that introduction, because you set out some of the reasons why the life sciences sector is so important. And it's also, I mean, it is the jewel in the crown of the British economy. It's one of the areas where we have genuinely world-class capabilities. And it also builds on our country's really proud history of medical innovation and research. I mean, if you think about it, from the first mass immunization programs 60 years ago, you know, the discovery of DNA, developing the CT and MRI scanners, and then going on to the groundbreaking treatments for cancer like CAR T therapy, which the RVI in my constituency in Newcastle, and I have to get that in, of course, was one of the first hospitals to deliver. And of course, that's even without mentioning the COVID-19 vaccine. So I think looking ahead, we can expect that a thriving life sciences sector can play a major part in supporting the first of Labour's five missions for government, which is to secure the highest sustained growth in the G7. And that is growth in all parts of the country, not just the greater southeast. In the north, life sciences already contribute almost £14 billion to the economy. And the region is actually home to a fifth of the UK's life sciences workforce. So we're seeing a revolution in the life sciences sector. We in the UK need to be able to capitalize on that. We're dropping down the global league tables, unfortunately, and we'll probably talk about some of the reasons for that. But we must never forget that we have the NHS as a unique asset for life sciences in this country. And part of our the reason for our emphasis on that, as well on this sector, as well as driving economic growth, we can improve outcomes in the NHS for people. And that's why we announced Labour's plan for the sector, which is called, wait for it, A Prescription for Growth, which I recommend to everyone to read. And it sets out in much more detail the potential, the opportunity, and some of the policies that we'll be putting in place should we be elected to drive life sciences across the UK.
Okay, a lot to go into there. But before we do, Stephen, I wanted to talk to you about the Life Sciences Future 50 report, which PwC has just recently published. Can you tell us a bit about that and kind of, you know, how that relates to what G was saying?
Sure. Hi, Emma, and thanks for having me on the podcast. I think there's going to be some violent agreement. I completely agree with G in that, you know, the life sciences sector is a hugely important strategic sector for the country, and an area where there's, you know, the quality of the science is outstanding, and we're really passionate about that at PwC. And it's one of the main reasons why we produced the Future 50 Life Sciences Report. You know, we wanted to celebrate and showcase some of the amazing science that's being developed in the UK. So the report highlights 50 of the most innovative, exciting and groundbreaking companies operating in UK life sciences today across therapeutics, across medical devices, diagnostics, digital health and artificial intelligence. And it was really a culmination of, you know, many months of research across the UK life sciences ecosystem. So where we spoke to investors, we spoke to the life sciences companies themselves and other market participants, really to gain insight into the types of companies that are out there, you know, and what really sets them apart. What is it that differentiates them? And I have to say, and Dan and Chi will no doubt know this, the quality of the companies and the cutting edge science and the future potential is truly awe-inspiring. But what we also did in the report was to identify the economic contribution that the sector has to deliver to the UK economy. And, you know, it's clear that the sector is a driving force for future growth. It's delivering life-changing health outcomes for patients, and it's a hotbed of talent, you know, developed in the UK, but also attracting and drawing in international talent from around the globe. So while it's difficult to do it justice in a few minutes, it is available online. But what we know is that we showcased 50 companies. Actually, there were so many more to choose from. And, you know, many of these companies are either already or have the potential to really change the face of human health.
Great. Dan, let's bring you in now. As a long-term investor in the life sciences industry, and the UK's life sciences investment envoy, what level of investment does the sector need, and why is that really important for society?
So I think the level of investment is considerable, actually. So I think I agree with everything that's been said, but I think the challenge for us is scaling our companies, mm-hmm. which is a combination of them getting bigger, but also those products actually having an impact on society. One of the analyses that the Bioindustry Association did was we estimate over the next 3 to maybe 5 years, we probably need about 10 to 15 billion pounds to scale the companies that, you know, Steve has identified. You know, he talked about more than 50 companies out there. That's the quantum of capital that's needed just to scale those companies. We still need capital that goes into the early stage startups and sort of, you know, smaller companies getting things out of our universities as well. So I think that's a bit of a challenge. And I can talk a bit more about some of the work that we've been doing with sort of various parts of government to try and get our pensions fund industry to actually invest in that. And obviously, I think the Labour Party issued a report about a year ago with Jim O'Neill talking about productive finance. Tony Blair Institute has talked about this. I think there's cross-party agreement that we need to get more sort of productive finance. And I think life sciences, to my mind, obviously, we're all, well, not all of us are biased here. I know Steve and I are, but sort of life sciences is one of the industries that I think should be one of the recipients of that capital.
Absolutely. And, you know, when you're saying that we're struggling to scale, is that because most of the companies that are coming out of the UK are spin-offs from universities?
I think we struggle to scale. So scaling a company needs two things. It needs people and it needs money. that's all. But I think that we do have the people. Remember, one of the big advantages we've got here is we've got AstraZeneca and GSK. We also have Smith & Nephew here. We have some big companies here that sort of where employ lots of people who have a lot of global experience. So I think you can attract the talent to come here, but you're not going to attract the talent if there isn't the money. So if I've got the choice of being, say, CEO of a company in Boston where I've got the ability to raise $100 million or CEO of a similar company in Cambridge, UK, where I can only raise $20 million, most people will opt for the US because obviously you've got, with more money, you've got more chance of being successful.
It's a very familiar story, isn't it? I mean, we hear a lot of that about when companies are looking at where to list. Often they go to US just because it's easier to raise capital.
Yes, and I think just to jump in on that, sort of to give you throw a number out there, one of the problems is our pensions fund industry, which is about £4.6 trillion, so it's pretty big. Over the last 20 to 25 years, we've seen a steady flow of money out of the UK equity markets. So if you applied the asset allocation of the pension fund industry that it had in 2000 to today's pension fund pot, there would be an additional £1.5 trillion invested in equities in the UK. That is an awful lot of money that is essentially just drained out of the bathtub. And that affects private companies. It affects the public markets. It's why our water companies aren't really owned by many British investors anymore. Essentially, that was a result of regulation from, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. But sort of that's what we need, in my view, we need to reverse. We need to actually start investing in Britain again across the board, not just government, but pension funds and individuals.
Dan, I suppose part of that, what that's also created, when you specifically think about life sciences, you know, over the last 20 years, you've also had a, you know, sort of, I suppose, a drain of the talent of individuals who focus on investing in life sciences, or analysts who understand the life sciences businesses. So you just don't have as much of an investor base or an analyst base here in the UK either. So it becomes a bit more of a vicious circle in that whole regard.
In our life sciences plan, and we sort of set out, well, we used, actually, I think it's figures from the Bioindustry Association, that if we have falling down the life sciences R&D global share, and if we could restore UK life sciences R&D share to its 2012 level, that would mean an extra £10 billion worth of R&D investment in the UK per year. And that's one of the, if you like, the prizes of making the UK more attractive for investment, but also making it easier to, as has been said, you know, easier for spin outs to grow and attract investment in the UK. And when we do have key reasons to invest in the UK, and also it's worth noting that as well as our research being excellent, our cost of research, you know, compares very well with US costs of research, for example. But we do need to step up the pace to improve the attractiveness of the UK, and that's what Labour wants to do should we be elected.
Chi, can I just kind of stick with you there, because I wanted to talk about how this is affecting you and me on the street. Like, what kind of impact does poor health in the UK have on our economy?
A poor health in the UK has a huge impact on our economy, and I could talk about this for hours, but I'm just going to highlight two specific areas. One is the people who are inactive in our workforce, and since COVID, we have seen that the UK, unlike many other countries, we still have, I think, around a missing million from our workforce, who out of the workforce for reasons of ill health or disability, or, you know, for reasons that we don't know, but we suspect are related to that. And that's, you know, that is sort of, as well as the lives blighted by that, it's also a huge economic drain. And it doesn't, it means that we're not punching it out at our full weight, that we're not benefiting from the talents of all the people in the country. And then there's also the impact on particular diseases, whether that be from dementia, the huge cost of dementia to the economy, to those caring with dementia, the difficulties in diagnosis, and the costs of the treatments available, which could target and identify cancers at much earlier stages, not being able to apply those quickly enough also has, you know, huge costs for our NHS as well. And just finally, actually, the health inequalities. So across Newcastle, there are differences in life expectancy of 12 years. And if you think, and particularly actually the issues are around healthy life expectancy. So, and the difference that makes both in terms of well-being and therefore also the costs to the NHS and in terms of our economy are huge. So getting life sciences right is a driver of improved public health, being able to, for the NHS to be able to adapt, to drive innovation through the NHS effectively, to benefit from our, you know, leading position in life sciences, to actually make people, you know, my constituents, able to benefit more from that. That just has huge benefits and economically as well as socially.
12 years is, I mean, that's kind of really quantifying things. But Stephen, can we quantify the positive impact investment in the sector has on people's health and on the wider economy?
Absolutely. I think if you think about some of the life sciences products. Clearly, you've got the direct impact of the life sciences companies. You've got then the indirect impact of the supply chains, and then you've got the spending of all those individuals. But you've also got, you know, the opportunity cost of actually getting those people back into work, and not only the patients themselves. You've got the families, and often the carers are family members. They might be the partners, they might be the parents, they might be the daughters or sons. Getting those individuals back into work is massively important. And so we did some research clearly on for the Life Sciences Future 50, in that the sort of 43.4 billion you mentioned is the gross value added economic benefit. But we've also done some research on the economic impact of access to some of the innovative medicines. And we worked with the ABPI a couple of years ago, you know, looking at just 13 medicines across 4 disease areas. And if you were able to improve access to these innovative medicines just to the level that NICE recommends is the eligible patient numbers, actually you deliver sort of £18 billion worth of productivity gains just to the UK alone. So, you know, obviously if you extrapolate that to a wider portfolio of innovative drugs, that's massive.
Wow. Okay. Dan, I mean, T kind of mentioned a couple of diseases that, you know, are crying out for investment in the UK at the moment. Are there any other areas? You know, she discussed dementia there and cancer treatment. Is there anything else that we should be focusing on or that we're particularly good at and that need more investment?
Well, I think there are two areas that we're really good at. And one of those is cell therapy. There are uses of those in oncology. So the CAR T therapies, I think, were mentioned earlier that have been used in Newcastle. But sort of there are other uses for cell therapy. So these are regenerative therapies. So they can essentially, can recover biological function that may have been depleted or doesn't exist. So things like type 1 diabetes, for instance, you know, there could be cell therapy approaches to that. The other area that we're very good at is genomics. And I think that sort of you saw this during COVID, really, that I think sometimes people underappreciate how well we did in terms of not just in terms of vaccines, but also the sequencing of COVID variants that are being done. So all those testing centers across the country created a lot of data. The UK, particularly the Sanger Institute up in Cambridge, sequenced something like 25% of all COVID samples globally.
Wow.
And what that enabled us to do was actually you could see infections kind of moving across the country, as it were. So when they talk, you know, all the different variants that people talked about, we were at the cutting edge of science. And I think when you talk, and I think Chi talked about prevention, which I think is really important, and areas like genomics can be used to sort of try and prevent or diagnose or identify diseases before they happen. We've got a lot of the technologies here. And I think sometimes we just need to be brave enough as a nation to jump into the unknown and be the first to actually implement some stuff. And actually, in the medical world, Britain has been a leader since 1948 when the NHS was actually launched. You know, we were a leader, well, not me, but sort of as a nation, we led the way in things like tuberculosis, which was a huge problem in 48. And new treatments for tuberculosis. We've been very good at sort of what's called translational medicine, taking things out of the lab or sort of on the shelf and actually implementing them into medical practice. And we've got a long, long history of that. And it feels as though that we just need to be a bit braver and sort of go for it, as it were. Trust in ourselves and trust in Britain.
Does the NHS give us a particular advantage? Like, you know, there's obviously it's a huge amount of data there that we have. Does that make us, or could it make us better at this stuff? Or is it just a kind of a nice thing to have, but it's not helping us from a scientific point of view?
I'll just come in on that quickly, because I know the answer to that is yes. the NHS, as well as being such a source of pride for the UK, but the NHS does give us a huge advantage in a number of ways. I mean, you mentioned data, having access to, in a secure way, in a trusted way, the data for, you know, this huge, the the country's population, so a huge cohort, we're not accessing or using or analyzing that data as well as we could be. But even what we're able to do today in terms of identifying correlations between particular populations and particular diseases or particular therapies and particular diseases, that is hugely beneficial. And also, this is where, you know, we do need to, I think as Stephen said, we do need to get better, but we have the ability to, if we can, you know, to pull through innovation from the lab to, as in the case of COVID, to people's arms, you know. And in the case of COVID is a really interesting case in what worked there to do that so quickly. And what we want to do as part of Labour's health mission, we're committed to developing what we're calling a comprehensive innovation and adoption strategy in England to help pull through new products and the services that can make a difference to in all NHS healthcare settings. And just finally, what that also means is that we should be able to pull through the manufacturing and the industry, which goes with that. And that means, you know, great jobs in pharma for my constituents in the future.
And if I could add to that, I think I agree with all of that, but also healthcare is a global industry. So if we are the first to implement a technology here, our companies will be selling that all the way around the world. And that brings more jobs, more economic growth, more profits back to the UK. And that should never be forgotten. I think sometimes we think about life sciences can cure the ills of the NHS. We can actually cure the ills of the world, as it were, and maybe not all of them, but if you do one or two, then that would be great for the world, but it'd also be great for, you know, economic growth in the UK.
It will act as a virtuous circle. It will attract many of those multinational foreign direct investors to look to the UK to build research facilities, to build manufacturing sites in advanced therapies or diagnostic reagents. And that's, you know, in a world where actually, you know, the economy is more challenged, actually you need those partnerships, you need that foreign direct investment to come in and really help to grow that.
I was going to say, a more violent agreement there, that I think collaboration, and that's one of the reasons why we were so concerned about the 139 weeks we weren't in Horizon, collaboration in Europe, but also globally. And that's where Britain, with its with its overseas development aid budget, can be effective. Global collaboration is really important for us, for the UK, and what we want to see is more of that collaboration across the world, because climate change is also a health crisis, and we need to be well positioned to help address that.
Stephen, I just wanted to move to you to talk about, you know, we've alluded a couple of times here to the UK falling down the global rankings. Can you explain why that is and what's needed to kind of reverse that? And what exactly, which global rankings exactly as well?
Well, I think actually when you talk about global rankings, there are so many positives. And we've got four of the top 10 academic institutions for life sciences and medicine. I think some of the global rankings relate to commercial clinical trials and how actually, you know, you take the vaccine, the COVID vaccine, that was an amazing example where the vaccine task force and stakeholders came together to deliver clinical trials in the UK, to deliver vaccine rollout, and actually is a positive. Since then, the number of commercial trials has dropped quite significantly in the UK, and that has a big knock-on impact. It has a knock-on impact on the understanding of innovative medicines with key opinion leaders and healthcare professionals, and therefore, you know, adoption. It has an impact on the funding that comes from pharma and life sciences companies, and it just makes the UK less attractive to the industry. And so, you know, all of those situations impact or can impact the, you know, access to innovation and the UK economy. So I think there, you know, we know what good looks like, and I think there is probably a need to think about how we make that work better for us. And it does come back to collaborations. You know, we've got the NHS, we've got NHS hospitals, we've got great healthcare professionals, and we've got a good base of life sciences. And I think greater collaboration on all sides needs to really happen to drive that forward.
Okay. And Dan, can you talk a little bit about, you know, the particular challenges the UK is facing in attracting investment and what advantages we do have? And I guess this conversation has suggested the NHS is one of those big ones.
So I think, as with all things, our advantages can also be our disadvantages. So I think we need to turn these things into a positive. I think one of the areas where we used to be a real leader was in regulation. And not want to get too political, notwithstanding there's a politician on this podcast, but post-Brexit, we lost a lot of expertise from the NHRA just because essentially the centre of the EMEA went to Amsterdam, was away from London.
And what's the NHRA?
NHRA is the regulatory authority that approves drugs and medical devices, essentially says whether things are safe, what the risk-benefit is. The EMEA is the medical evaluations agency that's part of Europe, which obviously we're no longer part of. Now, having said that, they've done a fantastic job. We were the first country to approve a COVID vaccine. So June Rain, who runs MHRA, I think is excellent. But my request to the shadow science minister, if she ever is in the right position, is we should be putting more money into it. Because I think we have good people. And I think one of the other challenges for government is when you look at some of these technologies like AI, et cetera, it's really competitive to get the talent. And so we need to find ways of getting those people into positions in, say, a regulator, whether it's a financial regulator or whatever, where we can actually pay to get really good people in, which kind of breaks pay scales, et cetera. And I don't know how you fix that. But but getting good people into position is really important. So I think that if we want to get our system joined up, as it were, it's great that we've got world-class universities, but it needs to be joined up with a process of translating that, a process of regulating that, and a process of actually innovating that within our medical system. And we've got all the pieces there. They just need to possibly be plugged in a different way with the right money.
That's absolutely a key area for us. And my I'm a chartered engineer. My last role before coming into Parliament was working for a regulator in the telecom sector, which in that challenge of getting the right people. I mean, it can be about pay, but it's also about, you know, understanding that you're going to be actually making a difference to such a key area. And one of the things, what we've said is that we were going to establish a regulatory innovation office to help end regulatory backlogs and to support, hold regulators to account, but to provide them with strategic steers, you know, for where to be looking at the future. And just as you said, to make sure that we have the resources and the policies in place so that regulation is a barrier, but regulation can also be an enabler. When you have the highest standards of regulation and when you have consistent and coherent regulation, that's where you can help new market products to develop. And that's what we want to see for life sciences in the UK.
Okay. And we've got about 5 minutes left. I just want to jump to Stephen. And just talk a little bit about who are the UK's main competitors when it comes, you know, there's a pot of money, right, that's going to go into life sciences. So who are we competing with?
Well, I think we touched on it earlier. The reality is that the US really dominates the space in terms of global life sciences at the moment. And so I think, yeah, I think according to the British Business Bank, US life sciences companies are 17 times more likely to raise funding rounds of more than 30 million. But the US public markets, the NASDAQ in particular for life sciences, is just more competitive right now. And so, as Dan mentioned earlier, it's just much more attractive. If you want to raise funding, the expectation is the valuations are higher. And actually, You've also got other European countries moving and supporting their life sciences companies. So Switzerland a few years ago shifted their pension fund rules to allow more investment into growth capital. And so, you know, I think that there are other ecosystems that are competitive. I don't think they have, you know, those European countries that have as high quality science coming from the academic institutions. but we're not there when we look at the sort of US capital markets.
Okay. And just to finish, Chi, we touched on kind of prevention earlier, but how can UK life sciences companies deliver the kind of preventative side of medicine? So we talked a little bit about dementia there, we talked about cancer. What's their role in preventing these diseases?
Well, I think their role in preventing the diseases can be absolutely critical if the right incentives and enabling environment is in place. So we're seeing with advances in technology and for, you know, as well as genomics, we also bio engineering, which could enable us to engineer biology, potentially including human biology, as we engineer our built environment. At the moment, there are enormous potential there for in terms of understanding each individual human body, and therefore being able to understand and prevent future threats. And there's also, in a sort of less sort of technological way, to understand the data which enables us to understand who may be most at risk from diabetes or from certain forms of cancer. But at the moment, I think it's true to say that the NHS isn't geared to be a sort of national illness preventative service, or indeed, a national health service. It's a sort of treatment service, and we need to do more. That's why we have with our innovation, a health innovation sort of an adoption strategy to make the NHS more. Our second mission, just specifically mentioned, which is to get the NHS back on its feet again, and an NHS fit for the future, and the future must be about preventing illness and disease, and being able to pull that through the NHS. And that was also is some knotty issues around pricing and the incentives to work better with the private sector on this.
Okay. Well, I think that's a great kind of note to wrap up on. Thanks to Chi Anwara, Dan Mahoney and Stephen Ahern for joining me. Head to pwc.co.uk to read the Life Sciences Future 50 report. It looks at 50 examples of UK life sciences companies that are demonstrating world-class science and innovation and tackling important challenges in scientific research and human healthcare. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can find more of Spotlight's policy reporting in our standalone Spotlight podcast feed or at newstatesman.com/spotlight. I'm Emma Hazlett, and our producer has been Catherine Hughes. Thanks for listening.